So I'm going to start with just reminding us about a few hard truths out in the world and back here, and then I do want to talk about things that I think we need to do. But and I know I'm speaking to a room full of people who are very knowledgeable and who read a lot and who care a lot. So maybe you'll hear things you think I already know that, and I'm sure you do. But I think it's important on World Water Day to recognize that we don't live in little pockets, that we live in a global reality, and just to remind us of the fact that too many of us, and certainly those, the more sophisticated, industrialized, and modern we get, the more we disassociate from nature. And we see water as a resource for our convenience and profit and building of the industrial cities and agriculture that is so harmful, and that is instead of seeing water as a sacred source of life. And I just want to remind us that we are a planet running out, which is something we learned back in grade six wasn't possible, but I assure you it is. We're damming, diverting, polluting our rivers to death, and over-extracting groundwater. I'm just going to just three, four short little new, brand new studies. Two of them, one on major rivers and one on the largest lakes and reservoirs in the world, both done with NASA aid. Found that half the planet's major rivers have seen a dramatic drop in water flow in the last half century, and over half the largest lakes and reservoirs on the planet are shrinking, many, many dramatically, many disappearing. A find the scientists who conducted the study called staggering. Many new studies on groundwater level, and just to remind us that over half the population of the world is dependent on groundwater for its day-to-day water needs, and we are pumping it way faster than it can be replenished. The UN says by 2030, demand for water will outstrip supply by 30%, 40%, sorry, even worse. And they've just published a report you probably saw that said the world has moved beyond a water crisis, and I quote, entered a state of global water bankruptcy. As it is, one quarter of the world's population drinks water contaminated with feces every day, and over half the population does not have adequate access to basic sanitation. So imagine during COVID when we were all told to wash our hands with soap and warm water all the time, and half the population of the world didn't have that. So consider what it means to these water-starved billions when the UN reports that we are collectively consuming water far faster than nature is replenishing it, and saying that we're causing irreparable, their word, damage to the planet's aquifers, lakes, and rivers. So when we come back to our country and the province of BC, we really see that we have a special responsibility because we have been given more than most. We have been given a very rich heritage, the people who are privileged to be here on this land. And I don't have to tell this group that we have approached the care of water with the same attitude as we've approached the care of forests, which is not good. I call it the myth of abundance. We all are told all the time we have 20% of the world's water. That's only true if you drain every lake and river and reservoir. Basically, we have about 7% of the world's accessible water that won't destroy the stock. And we are not caring for it properly. And I don't have to tell this group about the appalling human rights violations around access to water in First Nations communities. We have no water to waste or abuse. If you look at every month, Agriculture Canada has a drought map, and on it they tell you what the drought conditions are for that month. In the summer, the drought map said that over 85% of Canada was in some form of serious drought. Now, there's been snow. I can tell you most of it's right here. I'm looking out the window at it. It's still snowing and it's spring, but we have made it marginally better. Now, only 53% of the country is in drought, classified from abnormally dry to extreme drought. I think it's really important for us to situate ourselves within a situation where this water is not as we think of it in our music and lore and literature as being, unlimited. It is not unlimited. And in BC, you're experiencing multi-year drought. And you know, and all of you, I'm sure, are involved in the issues around logging and fracking and LNG exports and mining and bottled water extraction. And you know that there have been deep provincial cuts to watershed health and restoration, almost 80% in just 4 years. And you know that BC has one of the lowest industrial water rates in the country, shocking for a province living with drought threats. So we start. You know, we're starting already from a position of not caring for water, but I have two additional concerns that I kind of newer concerns that I want to raise today. And I promise I'll get to some good things. First of all, we all know that because of the Trump threats around the 51st state and the tariffs and so on, that we have to wean ourselves off our total dependence, economic and I would say political dependence on the US. And those of us who were around in the 1980s to fight that first Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, I tell you, I want to take out a full-page ad in the Globe and Mail and say, we told you so. We said we were not anti-trade. Everybody threw us at it as if we didn't care about, you know, finding exports for Canada's goods and so on. But we said, do not put all your eggs there. Do not trust that a superpower that may change its mind is going to care for Canada in the way that it has. And just as one example, in the early 1980s, manufacturing accounted for about 85% of our GDP. It is now under 10%. We went back to being hewers of wood and drawers of water because we lost the ability to say, no, that has to stay here so we can have secondary manufacturing. We lost all that. And it's, excuse me, it's crazy making for me to hear Pierre Poilievre come along and say, I know, how about an auto pact? Well, we can give American cars coming into Canada tariff-free entry if they get set up jobs here. And I think that's what the auto pact in 1960 was. Managed trade, a win-win for all, right? And it had to go because of the trade agreements that you can't have that kind of protectionism or those kind of rules. So it just struck me as ironic that the party that brought us this in the first place has left us here. So, but we know that we have to diversify our trade. We know we have to have more production in Canada, and we understand this is going to be meaning that we're going back to exploitation of our natural resources. I mean, it's kind of like take a deep sigh, and how are we going to deal with this? Because we know this is coming. Federal and provincial governments, all of the provincial governments, doesn't matter whether they're NDP or conservative or liberal, all of them are calling for the cutting of what they call red tape. Now, sometimes I guess there is overlap or rules that are old and don't mean anything anymore, but my antenna go up and the red lights go on when I hear cutting red tape. The way we're hearing it being talked about. The federal government has identified 500 so-called, and this is their quote, burdensome regulations. And BC even evoked the Second World War to explain why, and I quote, eliminating unnecessary red tape and bringing down barriers to growth is crucial. And that was in order to expedite the approval of at least 18 new energy and mining projects in the province. So we are beginning to see putting our resources out to the world, and particularly water, to bring about this turnaround that we need. And Mark Carney has said, and he wants to, this is on record, to turn Canada, and I quote, into the world's largest energy superpower. And this means more pipelines, more LNG, more critical mineral exploration. We're going to see it all through the North, I promise you that. And plans for Canada to become an AI powerhouse, artificial intelligence powerhouse. Evan Solomon, who's the Minister of AI, says this is our Gutenberg moment. That's his words. And plans for Canada to become this powerhouse. AI, artificial intelligence, is a major threat to water. The average 100 megawatt data center consumes about 2 million liters of water every day. The largest threat is around the Great Lakes, where we know that there are already hundreds and hundreds more planned of these data centers because obviously of the water there. The Chicago-based Alliance for the Great Lakes, which is a small C conservative group, this isn't a radical organization, put out a report a couple of months ago warning that mega data centers, AI data centers around the Great Lakes, could drain the already endangered groundwater supply of the region. If they said if you don't put strict protections in place, and they pointed out the drought has already driven the St. Lawrence River water levels to near historic lows. And AI is coming to British Columbia. I know you know that. Bell Canada is planning a super cluster of major centers, starting with Kamloops and Merritt. Already there's a protest going around another proposed center in Nanaimo. There are so many concerns around AI. The tech bros in the United States who absolutely want to use artificial intelligence and Bitcoin technology and Bitcoin revenue to displace regulation. They absolutely want no regulation. They want their production and their money to go wherever they want without any questions. And I can tell you this, although the big one we're talking about is Bell, there are a lot of American companies now coming into Canada, American AI companies. And I promise you it's going to be a discussion in the CUSMA, the trade agreement talks, that they're going to say, we don't want different regulations, i.e., any regulations. When we cross the border, we don't want to say how much energy we use, how much water we use. We want the same lack of rules that Trump has allowed us to have in our country. EB has, and of course, energy. We know AI uses a huge amount of energy. Premier EB has acknowledged that this is an issue and said he would limit their access. But if the fracking model in BC is the example, they're going to give these AI companies all the water they need because they have this myth of abundance, this myth that it can never run out. And this is a problem coming at us. We are not prepared in this country. We're beginning to see pockets of resistance, but my worry is it's coming here and then here because the center arrives and then you start to get worried as opposed to having a conversation across the board. We need to put a halt to this. Food and Water Watch in the United States, I chair their board, wonderful organization working for food and water justice. They're calling for a moratorium on all new AI data centers. And Pedro Arroyo, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on the right to human right to clean water and sanitation, has called for a worldwide moratorium on AI, simply from the water perspective. He's saying there are many other issues, but just dealing, because that's his role is water, just dealing with water, that we're about to take an already parched world and already landscapes that are sinking. And water being an area of contest that we don't even talk about, such as all through the Middle East. I mean, Tehran, before the war, they were talking about moving the entire city of Tehran because the water table is gone. You can imagine living with everything else they're living with that. So we need to be thinking about how we're going to respond. My second newer concern, and it's not that this all comes in a rush, these come in pieces, but my newer concern is the subject of my new book coming out in about 6 weeks. It's called Earth for Sale: The Fight to Stop the Last Plunder of the Planet. And it's about the financialization of nature and the marketization of climate policy. Governments basically contracting out the responsibility for environmental and climate policy to the private sector, who's saying, we're here, we've got the answer. So let me define it. The financialization of nature is similar to the financialization of the economy. The financialization of the economy is instead of investing in goods and services, you invest in risk. You go where you think the money's going. And so money chases money as opposed to consciously thinking about what is needed in terms of goods and services for people. The financialization of nature is the process of converting natural resources and ecosystems into tradable financial assets, such as carbon credits, biodiversity offsets, and blue and green bonds. The large corporations and asset managers, and these large asset companies are a huge part of this because they've just got money to slosh around and nothing else, actually. That's what they are. They brought us to the same corporations that have brought us to this ecological brink realize there's a great deal of profit to be made from the trillions of dollars that has been pledged by governments, particularly wealthier governments, the UN, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and so on. In recent years, the concern around biodiversity protection, you know, the 30 by 30 language, you've heard it all, the blue protection of oceans, the 200 kilometer ocean protection, and so on, and water systems. There's a huge amount of money to be made by corporations if they can get in on this. But they also are making very big money from green investors, those individuals with good intentions who say, I bought blue bonds, I bought a nature bond, I put money into green stocks, I feel better. You've got university endowments, you've got huge pension funds that put money into nature and carbon offset bonds and that kind of thing. You get big NGOs putting money in. So if these corporations can turn this into a profit, there is a huge amount of money, not only to be made, but I do argue in the book, being made now. They also want to be able to continue to pollute. And this is the essence of the issue here, is that if the corporations can say, you don't need to change the system, capitalism is fine, unlimited growth is fine as long as we do the following things and we offset the damage that we're doing here with something over there. Then we'll be fine. And so they quote offset their pollution, which they're allowed to continue to do with something somewhere else. Their answer to the climate crisis, which many cash-strapped governments are now very ready to accept, is this: put a price on nature, bring it into the market where financial risk experts will govern it, and where it will have to compete to survive. This is something that started in many ways as a positive thing. There were scientists and environmentalists who said, look, in a market economy, in a capitalist system, unless you put a value on something, you're not going to take care of it. So let's measure it. I call it measuring creation. And this is data collection on ecosystem services, and it's well underway in BC and right across Canada. In fact, the International Monetary Fund has put a price on wildlife, and they say that a whale is worth $2 million and an elephant is worth $1.75 million, mostly in terms of ecotourism. It's a long story, but distressing. In other words, don't save them unless you can prove that they can fend for themselves in the market. Now, we haven't got a lot of that yet here in Canada. This is rampant in the US and Europe and with these big companies, and the damage is mostly in the global south. But we do have one here in the Great Bear Rainforest. The World Wildlife Fund is promoting a financialization of nature project there, claiming to support indigenous guardians to protect the forest. But I talked to Ian McAllister of Pacific Wild, and I said, what do you think? Because there were lots of doubts around if this thing is working or not. And he said the value of these trees is obviously worth more to cut down than any carbon scheme, or we wouldn't wit be witnessing so much logging in this area and other places. You need to have in your mind what this is basically, as I said earlier, contracting out government responsibility, but it's also for the corporations a way to look like they're doing something. And as in carbon credits, you for every measure of climate you can climate you claim you've saved over here, you can continue to pollute over here, and you get credits which you can trade. I give many examples in the book. I was meticulous, and in fact, I have almost 400 end notes, footnotes, whatever, because I wanted to be very sure I could demonstrate what I'm talking about. But there are so many examples of carbon trading has been just proven to be a fraud. But more recently, we're into plastic offsets. We're into bottled water companies using financialization of nature. Coca-Cola and Nestle, for instance, to cover their environmental footprints and their promise to be water neutral or plastic neutral or whatever, they send massive amounts of plastic bottles that have been recycled to poor communities in Africa and the Philippines to be disposed of. And they set up these facilities that nobody knows how to work, so they break down. And they train what they call garbage engineers, local people. Greenpeace and others have studied this. They watch the massive amounts of plastic being taken, not to the recycling plant, but out to an open field and being burned. George Monbiot of The Guardian, wonderful person. He said, he just nailed it. And I just want to quote from him. He calls the financialization of nature a magic powder that allows governments to avoid the hard choices, laws, and policies they should be making to deal with the many environmental crises we face by replacing political decisions with economic calculations. He writes that it's deluded to expect we can defend the living world through the mindset that is destroying it. And let me just give you his quote. He says, "The notions that nature exists to serve us, that its value consists of the instrumental benefits we could extract, that this value can be measured in cash terms, and that what can't be measured does not matter, have proved lethal to the rest of life on Earth. The way we name things and think about them, in other words, the mental frames we use, helps determine the way we treat them. The financialization of nature is the definitive expression of our disengagement from the living world. First, we lose our wildlife and natural wonders. Then we lose our connections with what remains of life on Earth. Then we lose the words that describe what we once knew. Then we call it capital and give it a price. This approach is morally wrong, intellectually vacuous, emotionally alienating, and self-defeating." I remember being in a very high-end kind of high-tech high school in Germany. They were becoming a blue school. And the principal clearly didn't like me or agree with me. And he brought me into the office after with some other staff and chosen senior students. And he was going to take me down a peg. As the students like me and they give me a standing ovation. He said, "Ms. Barlow, I bet you're anti-technology." And I said, "Well, I got here on a plane and I have my, technology. I'm just do not want us to trust technology to undo the damage we're doing. I think we could stop doing damage." But I had talked about caring about rewilding and regenerative agriculture and protecting biodiversity. And he said, "I have friends. I have brilliant friends, scientists, who tell me that we don't need to protect the big animals anymore. Just let them go. We can grow all our food in urban centers, and we need to let that phase of Darwinism pass," and so on. And what do you say to that? And the students were all leaning in, and I said, "I think you need new friends," which I thought was the appropriate comment. The kids loved it. They didn't like that guy. I remember that very clearly. But that's a mindset that Georges Monbiot is discussing. So what do we do? Well, I have three strong thoughts on this World Water Day. First of all, I want us to be more clear in our push to protect and defend the water in Canada. N We need a national campaign to put airtight protections in the face of the oncoming water grab. It's coming piecemeal. Let me give you one example. In my province in Ontario, up until recently, if a big company, an ag company or a quarry or a bottled water company, had a license to take a certain amount of water, but it wanted to sell its operations to another company, the new company had to go through a licensing process again. They had to apply, and the local community And particularly the indigenous community had a right to have something to say. Perhaps this company has a bad reputation. Perhaps the old company was taking way more water and they need to be reassessed. That's changed. They brought in a new rule where the company A can sell to company B and sell the water. And that, to me, is the first real water trading we're going to see in Canada. And if that spreads across the country, and I predict with this cutting red tape, this is one of the ways they can do this. I find it really, really frightening. I can tell you about water trading. If I get started, you'll never get me off. But Chile and Australia, it's been a disaster. but we need to support communities fighting local data centers, and we need to be calling on for a moratorium on new AI operations. I think we need. I'm worried that it's popping up here and there. And people are discovering it as it's coming to a community near them, and we're not ahead of it. We need to form strategic alliances with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people to seriously invoke the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as the foundation for this protection. When Trump first talked about the 51st state and the big tap that was on in Canada, he meant the Colorado River, but now he's got his eyes set on the Great Lakes. And by the way, he's talked about redefining that border so that the line that goes through the Great Lakes, it gives Canada half of the majority, not Michigan, obviously, but the others. He wants to that line to go up above. A number of organizations we called together came together to come up with a kind of a loose alliance. We call ourselves Defend the Water. And we're very concerned. We want to be ready for next steps with Trump when they come, because they will. But I think this alliance should be enlarged to a greater call. And I want to say I envisage a national conference. We had a huge national conference back in 2002 in Vancouver and brought in people from around the world to talk about fighting commodification and privatization of water. And then in 2009, the Council of Canadians and the Canadian Union of Public Employees held a big conference in Ottawa on the privatization of water services because Stephen Harper was in power. And he was saying to municipalities, if you want money, federal funding for municipal upgrading for your infrastructure, water infrastructure, you have to go with a public-private partnership. Otherwise, no money. And we thought we can either be negative and be against that, or we could put something positive out. So we created the concept of blue communities, which was where we went to municipalities and said, don't let them do this. Take a stand ahead of time. Promise to protect water as a human right, as a public trust, so no privatization, and stop providing bottled water at municipal events and all, on municipal property and so on. And it took off. Nanaimo became the first, and it just went right across the country. We now have, I think, 49 towns and cities in Canada that have become blue communities, and we won that fight. There are several small municipalities that have some private wastewater, but mostly we've kept water in public hands, and it's really important to remember our victories because that was an important one. It went international. Bern, Switzerland became the first international city to become a blue community, and since then, lots: Paris, Brussels, Los Angeles, Thessaloniki, Greece, lots and lots. Berlin had privatized its water services, and they had to have a referendum. It was just a disaster. The prices went up, the water wasn't protected, and so on. They held a referendum to get their government to hold a vote. And they kicked the private company out, and then they became a blue community. So no future municipality, municipal government in Berlin would do that again. And now we have the World Council of Churches is a blue community. So we have faith-based groups, we have blue universities, and we have blue schools. And I'm not anything official with the council anymore, but I work as a volunteer and put together a project on blue schools, which you find on the Council of Canadians website, and which is, I think, really the next step. We have to get just teachers and students. We've got to get everybody what I call thinking blue. And this was all part of a powerful global justice movement that we put together. for the human right to water and sanitation that led to the recognition by the United Nations on July 28th, 2010, that water and sanitation are fundamental human rights. And since then, we have almost 50 countries that have either amended their constitution to recognize the human right to water or brought in some form of law. So I want us to feel, when we feel overwhelmed, which I think understandably a lot of us are feeling today, watching what's happening around the world, that we have had wonderful successes where we have come together, but we need to do this in a really coordinated way. We need to raise our voices. Secondly, we must reject the financialization and the commodification of water and nature. And we have to embrace the rights of nature, a development the UN Secretary General says is the fastest growing legal movement of the 21st century. The rights of nature asserts that ecosystems, wildlife, and the earth itself are living beings with inherent rights to exist, evolve, and regenerate. And this, of course, means heeding and adopting a relationship with nature that Indigenous people and many people still living in rural communities around the world know and honor. And that is, we cannot protect the environment if we continue to assert human supremacy over nature in the pursuit of economic good. And finally, and I looking at the time, and I'm hoping we're going to have a few minutes to have a chat. We have to have hope. I deeply believe that hope is a moral imperative. If we say, I can't, I can't watch that anymore, I've got to turn the world off, there's no hope left, we're abandoning the young. And that's a terrible thing to do. We absolutely have to have hope. My last book was on this very subject, and I used the term wise hope. I borrowed it from a wonderful woman named Joan Halifax, who works, she's a spiritual advisor who works with men on death row. So you can imagine she has something interesting to say on hope, right? And she used the term wise hope to denote the kind of hope that faces up to the reality of our situation, but requires us to keep going anyway. Wise hope says that what we do matters, even if we cannot control the outcome. Wise hope says when you're feeling overwhelmed, step back, take a deep breath, and say, what is the next appropriate step to take? And take it. Here's my definition, and it took me most of the book to write to finally come up with. Wise hope is a commitment to protect all that is good for future generations and the planet, knowing that what we do matters, even if we cannot control the outcome. And that's a excuse me, that's a mistake many of us make. Well, I failed, and I'm going to, it didn't work, and I'm going to go away and feel sorry for myself. You can't control the outcome. You can only control what you do within the situation. But what you but you need to reach out to mend the part of the universe you can touch. And this is the important part. You have to have faith that others are doing the same. You don't know who they are, you don't know where they are, but you have to have faith that others are there who care in the same way that you do and are doing their part in a way that's going to come together in the greater good. I had a wonderful elder friend. She was just before she died when she was 95 a few years ago. She asked me, she held my hand. She said, Ma, do you have a quiet mind? And I said, not really. I wish I did. She said, I'll never forget this. You will when you learn to trust in the larger good of the universe and that you don't have to carry this burden alone. That's wise hope. And what you're doing here, gathered in Nelson today, is an antidote to the violence and the destruction that we're seeing in so many parts of the world, including our own country, of course. But this antidote is extremely powerful, and you want you to feel in your hearts that what you're doing is not only good, but worthwhile in the long run. And you may not live to see what it means, but we can do miracles together. So I'm going to just end with three of my favorite quotes, and then looking at the time, I'm pretty good. I half an hour. The first is from Rebecca Solnit. Many of you will know her beautiful book, Hope in the Dark. She says, "The world is wilder than our imaginations. Causes and effects assume history marches forward. But history's not an army. It's a crab scuttling sideways, a drip of soft water wearing away stone, an earthquake breaking centuries of tension. Sometimes one person inspires a movement, or her words do decades later. Sometimes a few passionate people start a mass movement. Sometimes those millions are stirred by the same outrage or the same ideal, and change comes upon us, like the change in weather," which I think is beautiful. I mean, I think of the pre-1917 Dominion Elections Act, so said no woman, idiot, child, or lunatic shall vote. The change comes upon us as like a change in nature, and we are transitioning to a new understanding of our relationship with the world, our relationship to the trees we cherish, to the water we cherish. And the notion of the rights of nature is coming up from the bottom. It's not coming from the top. And what will that mean? Will it end up in the Supreme Court? Probably. Probably, where Indigenous communities will say, UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, give me cultural rights, give me resource rights, give me the right to set the conditions for your entry into my territory and what you're doing here. I'll bring it on. I mean, I think that would be an absolutely wonderful fight to fight. But meanwhile, it empowers people because people say either the laws are inadequate to protect our environment or they're not being enforced. So we're not going to wait because we can't wait because we have to show this is hope. Hope is action. Action is hope. This is what we're going to do, and this is going to make the difference. And so what you're doing there today is that drip of beauty and hope in that antidote. The second quote that I love, and a lot of you will know Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote the beautiful book Braiding Sweetgrass, she said, "We have to polish the art of seeing. This means listening to plants and heeding the lessons of the natural world. What would it be like to live with that heightened sensitivity to the lives given for ours? To consider the tree in the Kleenex, the algae in the toothpaste, the oaks in the floor, the grapes in the wine, to follow back the thread of life in everything and pay it respect. Once you start, it's hard to stop, and you begin to find yourself awash in gifts." Gorgeous. And the last, and I hope we have chance for a chat here, a celebrated African American poet whose name is E. Ethelbert Miller. Look him up, he's wonderful. He says, "Place your heart in your hands and blow gently. Spread love like seeds." Thank you so much.